Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jo.
And I'm Jerry, and this is podcast 1B from series 3. We're at the start of a new series in time for spring, and last podcast we kicked off the A podcasts for series 3. So each month we'll be doing a podcast, 1A, 2A, 3A, etc., about the social work journey. We started with first contact, and we talked about lots of things, including overcoming history and biases, anti-oppressive practice, and how we can start to build trust in an encounter with someone. And it's great to see people downloading the podcast. It's been out for a week as we record this one. We've already got about 120 downloads, some from Europe, some from America, some from Australia, one from Barbados, which is quite cool.
I think we should go and visit.
Yeah, we should go over and meet them. So we do hope that you're enjoying the podcast, and do let us know what you think by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes. And we do look forward to hearing from you.
And today we'll be starting our other strand of podcasts. Each month, the second podcast, the B podcast, will be learning from other disciplines that can help us better understand how we can practice well. We'll be drawing on science, social science and the arts to gain insight. For example, learning from counselling about how to build relationships, or from economics about how to make fair decisions about funding. We actually often draw on other disciplines in our thinking, and so we want to share this with you. And we'll be trying to link our podcasts together by thinking about a discipline that will cast light on part of the social work journey that we've just talked about. So in this case, contact.
Yeah, and when we were thinking about first contact, it seemed that what happens when you first meet someone is really influenced by our biology. And how we relate to people when we first meet them is also very strongly linked to psychology. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And we're going to start with a couple of definitions. Biology is one of the sciences, and it is about life and living organisms, all the elements of that: physical structure, chemical composition, how they function and develop and evolve. More interestingly, maybe, it comes from the Greek, the study of life, which seems quite apt for social work. And psychology is the science of behaviour and the mind, both conscious and unconscious behaviours and thoughts. And it extends to looking at relationships. And psychology also comes from the Greek, from the study of the psyche or soul. So again, really relevant. And the first thing that I was wondering about when thinking about these disciplines is that thinking about biology and psychology reminds us of the importance of thinking about the body and the mind and spirit and relationships, which really links to the idea of biopsychosocial social work. And when I did my first placement as a student, I was in a hospice, and there was lots of emphasis there on the biopsychosocial approach within palliative care. So you're not just thinking about the physical situation that someone's in, but also thinking about the emotional and spiritual situation that they're in and the relationships that are going on for that person. So it's the kind of that whole approach.
I find this field endlessly fascinating. Ever since I could remember, I haven't been really content to just kind of be in the here and now. It's never been enough for me to know that things are just the way they are. I always wanted to know why. And this was just not about how fridges work or how you can talk down a piece of plastic and someone thousands of miles away can hear you. It was really, why us? Why human? Why do we behave the way we do? So what makes us tick? To me, I think we're alchemy at our finest. We're this mixture of atoms that have the ability to transform into completely different things depending on what pressure you put us under. You know, and some bits of us are pure gold and other bits of us are dross. And I always wonder why. And for me, I think as a social worker, you really need to have an informed view on human existence. You need to have thought about a whole range of really big questions, like, when do we begin to exist and live autonomously? What's the purpose of humanity? And do we exist for ourselves or because of others or for others? I mean, where does our soul reside? These are questions that kind of go to the heart for me of biology and psychology, and I guess religion as well. but we really need to think about them. You know, I want to know what the relationship is between our body and our brain. How do we manage to integrate that and pay attention to both? And what about our experiences and the person and nature versus nurture? And I think all these questions matter if you're a social worker. You really need to understand where you stand.
Yeah, because if social work is work with humans, it kind of starts with what makes us human, what is a human. And what we can learn from biology and psychology is that humans aren't just one part, but the kind of complex interacting whole. And also that we're not human in isolation because our species is social. So we can start to think about what are our systems, how do we hold together and what makes us work? How do we respond to the environment? What influence does the environment have on us and us on the environment and our relationships? Where does our behaviour come from and why do we behave like we do? How do we think? How do we relate to others? How we're influenced? And I was thinking back to my social work education, and we did cover life course development, attachment and relationships and ethics. And coming back to this topic has made me realise just how core those are to our role.
And I think for me, you know, as social workers, we're called upon as one of the tools that actually maintains a harmonious functioning of our society. And so we have to understand what type of society it is we're trying to maintain. And a lot of the answers to that question comes from our beliefs about what it is to be human and how humans should behave and what it is that we expect from each other. And rights, human rights, it's all those things, you know, and we need to understand who are the beneficiaries of this functionality that we're trying to maintain. And we need to kind of think about questions of ethics and questions of equity and whether what we're doing is conscionable. And I think that these questions are often skimmed over or dismissed as irrelevant. And like you, of course, I studied Rawlings and heaps of other people around social justice, and I looked at different frameworks for politics and all sorts of things when I studied social work. But somehow I kind of thought that doing the job was disconnected from that. And I think that what's happened for me is that over time, as I've evolved as a human, I guess, I've seen those things have connected more closely again. And I've started to realise that those big questions fundamentally influence the way I behave. Yeah. Because I have a real set of drivers that are influencing everything that I'm doing.
Yeah, and that made me think about the question of what biological imperative are we trying to meet or are we following when we undertake particular types of social work? And that led me to think about Daniel Kahneman's work about thinking fast and thinking slow. So the thinking fast being our instinctive responses, our evolutionary biological impulses, and thinking slow being our kind of reasoning about why we do what we do. And in social work, I think we have to do quite a lot of slowing down on our instinctive responses. And that goes not just for individual work with people like we were talking about in first contact in the last podcast, but also in our policy and strategic work. So we're not impulsively pushing people into where we think they should fit, but really thinking about where has that impulse come from.
And I think that's hard to do, isn't it? Because we're often in situations where our biology is triggered. And I know that we've talked about this in the past, but, you know, if your biology is triggered to make you feel wary or vigilant or anxious, then actually you're going to rely more on your instinct and you're going to kind of be often in survivor mode, you know, and that survivor in us, they're drivers that have enabled us to be the most successful deadly megafauna ever, really. There's no environment we can't plunder, you know. And so to be successful, we've had to really overcome some big obstacles. We're biologically limited in our physical body, but we're very adaptable and innovative. And that's really enabled us to move through worlds that we weren't built to inhabit. And I think that kind of drive in us is something that we have to harness consciously in as a social worker, because I think that we can be pushed into a place where we're seeing everyone as or everything as competition, and we're maintaining the status quo, when what we really want to do is harness that adaptable, innovative flexibility that has allowed us to create really different places and spaces. So instead of just feeding the status quo all the time, actually there's a job for us, isn't there, to pull back and question what it is that we're feeding or maintaining, and to ask, is there a different or better way to support and help people?
That competitive instinct can feed into the power that we have if we're not careful, into really unhelpful ways, can't it? And we can become like a threat to people because we're maybe very unintentionally, unconsciously portraying ourselves as stronger, you know, more alpha.
And enforcing the status quo, and it's the status quo that's kept people where they that people will often perceive has fed into their difficulties, because people are not only their biology, but they're also their environment and their experiences. And so people that we're working with will have difference in those to us. And if we're just kind of maintaining status quo, then I don't know that we're being particularly helpful.
Yeah, and this reminded me of has reminded me of some work that I did around adult attachment. And as a children's practitioner, you'll know a lot more about attachment than I've had the chance to really kind of think about. But that part of attachment theory, which is about the internal working models that we develop around how relationships work, and that I was thinking about that, and I was thinking also about this need to build trust and ensure that we're not seen as a threat. And what we'll often be doing is tapping into an internal working model that people have of relationships as threatening. So we're not only having to counter the power that we've got, we're also having to counter that experience of threat that people might have. And so we need to behave in ways that help people see us differently and help people understand their experiences and why they might see us as unhelpful rather than helpful, so that they can start to develop a new model which says, oh, a social worker is not a threat. A social work relationship can be a really empowering thing, and this there can be a real connection. So we have a lot of work to do there, don't we, to kind of counter biology and to counter some of those working models that people have developed from maybe years of seeing people in authority or people who have any power over them potentially as threatening.
Well, that's just, that is biology. Our brain does see difference as threat, and it sees change as threatening as well. And so if we're coming in telling people that life can be different and that they need to change so they can be different, that's not going, it's about that message, isn't it? And that's why coming in with a curious stance and saying, what is it that you're struggling with, and what would a life that you are content with look like, and how would you like to get there, and what seems possible to you at the moment, and what seems overwhelming, and kind of being really curious in the way that you see best practice all the time. And in the way, you know, when you read good reports about from children or young people or adults about what has been helpful to them, it always comes across that it's been that curiosity and that willingness to enter at an equal level. So not to present yourself as a threat.
Control and relationships and support are the factors that, from the work on stress that Health and Safety Executive have done, those are the factors that counter demand and change and kind of lack of clarity about what's expected of you, the lack of role clarity. So if we're offering those things, if we're offering people control over what happens to them as much as we can, if we're building a relationship and offering support, then we are countering those stressors, those threats that people experience.
And we keep coming back to relationships, don't we? And I think for me, this is just you know, humans club together because we actually find joyfulness in our interactions with each other. Humans love humans. And we're not an aloof or solo species. I mean, and individually we can want our own time and space, but most of us would rather live on top of each other on 60 floors than by ourselves in total isolation. You know, there's been so many studies done that talk about the real effects and tolls of loneliness. And, you know, we can argue that cities grew out of commerce and convenience and trade, but I think we should also consider that they grew out of the pleasure to be gained in the company of strangers, watching plays, listening to music, seeing art, dancing, praying, eating, struggling, helping. And I think it's this type of community that social workers are seeking to keep functioning. It's that kind of relational melting pot of life. And as humans, we work best if we have about 150 connections, apparently. That's about all we can manage. And only about 10 of them need to be intimate. So we have those intensely intimate connections, and then we have enough people to attend to, and then some in the background for colour and noise and all the wonderful things of humanity. And I think, you know, that's why we've created these systems of marriage and kin and then communities, schools, church, sporting and other groups. And that's all about relationship. And so for me, I think when we're trying to think about what are we maintaining in terms of humanity, what is it that we believe social work is all about? You know, we do necessarily keep coming back to relationship because that's the driver for us, isn't it, as humans?
Yeah, so we're trying to create connectivity for the people we work with, and we also need it ourselves. So what motivates us often, I think, to keep going in social work is connection. If you look at the research around why people stay in the job, it's because of peer support and managerial support. And so having connections ourselves taps into our own motivation. And if we're going to be change agents for other people, then there is a real need to focus on relationships, isn't there? Because we want to build relationships with them to help them motivate, that connectivity that helps motivate them to do things differently. You know, that belief that you'll maintain your relationship with your children, you'll develop a relationship with the community, you'll be able to have the chance to make friends, those kind of things. You'll maybe be able to have your intimate relationship with someone will grow, those kind of things. Those are motivators, aren't they, for people changing? And we also need to attend to our own connectivity in the workplace and our own support networks outside, so that we feel motivated to keep going.
And I mean, and that is really, you know, we're seeking that level of connectivity and the variety and the support. And for me, what you're talking about is a spirit of cooperation, which is humanity at its best, as opposed to the evocation of competition, which can also be good for humanity in small doses, but when it becomes destructive, like a yours and mine thing, particularly a fight over resources, then that's when it becomes problematic.
Yeah, and it counters one of the things that is discussed extensively in biology around the survival of the fittest kind of mantra. And because if we're doing cooperation and not competition, if we're promoting that, then that will be counter to some instincts that we have. And we will need to model something different from the way society often seems to work.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, social work for me is about us helping a group utilize the talents of people to the fullest, regardless of what package they're wrapped in. So regardless of how physically able or intellectually able or emotionally available they are, that there are things and places and spaces where they can shine and thrive. And it's that idea of, you know, even if you're not the fastest person to the banana, you can still eat. You know, it's just It's, you know, and social work is all about that, isn't it? It's a way that minimizes the need for intense competition for the basics so that we can become more alive to the potential of difference and how that can contribute to the betterment of our society. I mean, our society is made better because of the diversity of people who make it up, not because we're all the same. I think that's really key. And I think social workers play a huge role in protecting that diversification and promoting it.
Yeah, and if we're promoting diversity or difference, and we've talked about that being seen potentially as a threat, you know, difference is threatening because it makes people think about being human in different ways and maybe have to question their own identity a little. And also if we're promoting equality and dignity for all in a situation where there are finite resources, then there is going to be opposition. And I think one of the things that talking about biology and psychology has helped me consider is the need to understand what the drivers or the motivations behind opposition to social work, because it's not enough for us to say, well, social work is great and here's why and we should be doing it. We need to understand what people's objections or concerns might be about it, so that we can frame our arguments better.
I think that's and that's something we should think about more, because I've got to tell you honestly, Jerry, when you say that, I just go, what possible objection could there be to having people who are interested in promoting the health and well-being and diversity and dignity of all people in society, which is quite different to what social work roles are sometimes forced into being, which is why we have to be so careful about the social policing.
And yet there are arguments against using resources to help particular people. And there are people who are seen as a threat to the core values of our society. You know, so these are very real issues, aren't they? One of the things for me is that if we limit who we see as citizens and what we see as a good life, we limit the potential that people have and the potential for growth and development and evolution and improvement. Shall we talk about the implications for practice a little bit?
Yes, that sounds great.
We've talked about lots and lots of different things. There's so much you can say about biology and psychology because it is about humanity.
Yes.
I think the things that have really struck me are what makes a human and what causes us to do what we do is being really important questions for our individual work, but also for us as a profession, and where we get our ideas about humanity and behaviour and why we behave as we do. Those are a mixture of instinct and learned responses and reasoned responses. And we do need to be really adept at spotting what we're doing, and being curious about why we're doing it, and can understand our propensity to think quickly and react and try and slow things down and create some spaces. Harry Ferguson talks about creating stillness, doesn't he? Social work being on the move and us actually being still sometimes. And I think when we first meet people, some stillness is really good because it allows that kind of awareness of what's going on and that curiosity to kind of seep out. And also, the other thing we've talked about a lot is that social work is linked to society and society's view of how people are expected to be. And there's that real potential for us to be agents of conformity rather than promoting diversification and arguing for the potential of humanity. And so we will sometimes be seen as a threat, and rightly so, actually. It's good for our power to be challenged and you know, seen as overt.
Well, I also think if we're seen as a threat, we should always take that as an invitation to stop doing what we're doing and try and, from the other point of view, see why that would be.
Yeah, try and understand where that's come from, because one of the useful things that I learned from revisiting attachment was that there isn't such a thing as a bad relationship style. It's just one that doesn't work for that particular situation, and understanding where that adaption has come from, where it is successful and why it's coming through now helps us to then say, well, maybe that's not the best style now for us to be working in. Let's try something else.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing that social work can do really well, is it can help people feel safe and secure and attended to in a way that enables us to think through our biological and emotional responses and make sense and make choice. And I think sometimes when people are in high threat or high distress situations, that ability to go through that kind of step-by-step thought process is really curtailed. And one of the things that social workers are trying to do is help people feel safe enough to examine those behaviours. And we can't do that if people think of us as part of the problem.
And the other big thing for me that we've talked about is this importance of relationships and connectivity. So helping people thrive through relationships, and then also that including ourselves, thinking about what makes us thrive and what will sustain us and support who will sustain and support us.
The thing about us is that we're not just thought. There's so much else pushing in on us and so much that we're not even conscious of. But as a social worker, conscious competence, when we're intervening in the lives of other people, mindfulness, dare I say, I know it's a trendy word, but, you know, being able to be mind-minded and to be in the moment and to use every sense that you can is part of what will make our interventions effective. Harry Ferguson has a lot to say about that, about using all our senses in social work. And he asks, you know, where is the smell of social work gone? Why aren't we attending to everything and using all our senses? And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that we need to be, you know, we just need to try and really harness our biology.
Should I mention a couple of tools that we talked about? There's some I think are quite helpful that think about our drivers. There's one that we use with managers which looks at what our major motivations are. Is it about pleasing people or being seen as strong or being fast or trying hard? And quite a simple way of thinking about what our drivers are is to think about when you feel valued and when you don't, and what the other person valued and what maybe they didn't notice, because that tells you a lot about what your motivations are. Another thing I thought about was about looking with people we work with around what motivates them. There's a really good person-centered tool called Good Day, Bad Day, to think through what a good day looks like and what a bad day looks like. And that really helps show up what's important to them and what motivates them. And I suppose there's just a caveat really around using tools about personality. There's really helpful kind of personality tests and tools out there, like the Kubler-Ross grief cycle, that help us see what someone's response to change might be. It's just about knowing where those things come from, what evidence underpins them.
And I think, too, all of these things are contextual. So the day and the time and the space and place in which you do these little tests or use these tools also inform the results, as does your age and stage of development. So how you behave as a 20-year-old is unlikely to be the same way that you're going to behave as a 50-year-old. So all those things make any tool that you use contextual. So I think one of the things that's really important when you're trying to attend to yourself in this way is always, like you would with someone you're working with, put the date and the time and your mood or any other important information on top of the tool, so that when you go back and look at it, you can say, actually, I was behaving in this way and these were some of the environmental or biological or psychological effects that were happening for me at the time.
So we had a couple of reflective questions to finish up with. And the first one is thinking about how you've been today. Why did you behave as you did? What can you understand of your own behaviour, your own recent behaviour? And also, from all the different things that we've talked about, and there could have been many, many more, is there something that has inspired you to go and find out a bit more?